Good to see everyone on this beautiful Sabbath morning. Now, if you were here last week, you know that I'm doing a three-part series on the subject of authentic happiness, based on a book by that same title, Authentic Happiness, by Martin Seligman. And last week, I gave out a summary of what I had to say. Somebody called it the Cliff Notes. And if you'd like those, they're in the table out in the narthex right there. And there's also a copy from what I'm about to say to you now in the next few minutes. They look kind of alike, so look at the title. Last week's are sitting under a blue pile right now, but maybe they'll get shifted around. But they have the dates on them. So Jesus called people to what he calls the abundant life, a life of blessing and spiritual happiness. And the author of our book, Martin Seligman, made up a formula, very simple one, H equals S plus C plus V. And all that means is H is for happiness, equals S, which he called a set point that we inherit, genetically conditioned or somehow gain it while we grow up, of how optimistic, how cheerful, how happy we tend to be. And then the second thing is C, and that stands for the circumstances of life. And last week I talked about some of those, that money doesn't make you happy after a certain point. And moving won't make you happy either, so you can forget both those things. And there are some other things. And then the last thing is V, which stands for voluntary. There are things that we can choose to do voluntarily that can tend to make us more happy. So I told you last week, I hope we'll all become authentic happyologists, and I'll renew that plea, hoping that we will. So, what are the factors that are under our control about happiness? Well, one thing is how we view the past. Now, maybe I should just take a digression here for a moment. One of my cardinal beliefs is that because religion, our religion, our faith, we believe is the truth, the absolute truth. That means that if we encounter truth from some other source, let's say science, for example, there ought not to be a conflict. There ought to be ways that these truths can be harmonized together. Now, not every religious person thinks the way I just said. So you heard it here. This is my opinion. But if they don't seem to match up, then I think we need to wrestle with why not? What's wrong? Something's wrong somewhere. And I believe they do match up. I've been fascinated all my adult life with the connection, the relationship between psychology and religion. Some people may say, well, psychology is not a science. Okay. But it uses data and attempts to prove the truth or falsity of things. So I like how they intertwine. And in this case, they do. So one thing that's under our control is how we view the past. Now, Seligman makes the point, which is commonly held by many people, even many psychologists, perhaps most, that our adult life in the present is determined much by our past experience. For example, Lydia and Mark are divorced. Whenever Lydia hears Mark's name, she remembers that he betrayed her, and she still feels intense anger 20 years after the event. Another example, when Abdul, a Palestinian refugee living in Jordan, thinks about Israel, he imagines the olive farm that his family once owned, which is now occupied by Jews, and he feels unmitigated bitterness and hatred. Now, many people, perhaps you and me, we carry around our past hurts and resentments and guilts, and these can burden us in the present. Other people sometimes are able to let these things go, and they're not a burden. So Seligman says that it's a good thing to shed these things, this baggage, this stuff that's clinging to us. He said it's sort of like when you're working outside on a hot day and you get covered with sweat and mud, you came in and took a shower, and how good it felt for all the muck to be coming off. I'd like us to be free and clean of the things from the past that do hurt us, that drag us down. Well, how can we do that? Well, here are some ways. One way, Seligman suggests, is by adopting, quote, the attitude of gratitude. Now, this is another favorite subject of mine, and something that I've been working on for, 10 or 20 years, is to be more thankful to God and more thankful to people, to go out of my way to thank people when they have done something good and make sure that they know that I noticed and I appreciate it. As a matter of fact, in getting the sermon together, I woke up and remembered, you know, I'm not doing that as well as I have in the past, so I'm going to renew my effort on that one. But having an attitude of gratitude is a really healing thing. I know a woman well whose husband died. They had a long and wonderful marriage, and she was really at a huge loss when he passed away. But she said that she, after a few weeks, began to adopt the attitude of gratitude, in which she remembered and focused on the happy memories that they had together, the good times, the good things, and even that spilled over into the present, the good things with her family and her friends. And I know this lady well. She's up in her 90s, but you wouldn't know it looking at her. She's very well adjusted and probably one of the happier people I know. So it works. I invite you to join me in working on that attitude of gratitude. Now, Seligman suggests two ways that we can do this. One way is to think of someone who's really influenced your life in a good way and write that person a thank you note. You know, you could do it on email or call them up. You know, that's a rare thing when people do that. And I'll tell you what, it makes the receiver really feel good. It's a good thing to do. Seligman also suggests this. He says at the end of every day, and his idea is you do this just before you brush your teeth, is write down 5 things you're grateful for that day. Now, I don't know about you, but I have all my great ideas when I'm either brushing my teeth or taking a shower, but I never can write anything down. But I do think that being more thankful is something that all of us Christians could do and could work on. And that includes even in worship, giving Thanksgiving a more prominent role. I like that idea. Okay, a second way we can shed the past is to forgive and forget. Now, I know some people have a problem with this because when they hear the word forgive, what they think of is pretending that it was okay, of condoning the bad thing that happened, whatever it was. But that is not what forgiveness means. If it was bad, it was bad, and it's still bad now. But it means that we're breaking its power to hurt us in the present. Seligman writes, you cannot hurt the perpetrator by not forgiving, but you can set yourself free if you forgive. And that's right. That's the point of it, to let ourselves be free of it, whatever it is. He used an example of a woman named Adele, an African-American woman who grew up in Alabama. And she looks back over her life, and she feels now serene and proud and at peace. She feels she overcame the adversities of being a poor black female growing up in Alabama. And that all the hurts associated with that, she says, I sucked that lemon dry. You know, lemons make you pucker up. The past no longer holds her. I had a professor once say that anyone could change the future, but only an historian can change the past. You know, historians are always rewriting history. They have new insights, new ways of looking at things. And that's good for us to do. When we keep going over the same old things the same old way, maybe we're missing seeing it from a different perspective. Maybe it can break the hold it has on us if we are free to do that. I believe that. So along with being authentic happyologists, let's all be historians. Historians who changed it, I'll think of it in a minute, you know, starts with R. I'm not getting old. No.
Reconstruction.
Reconstruction, that's one word for it. Yep, yep. Revisionist historians. Yay! Okay, so changing the past is possible. Secondly, Seligman says we can be more happy if we voluntarily control our optimism. We do have some control over that. That's another thing I feel a need to work on. Perhaps you do too. To believe that the bad things that happen to us are neither persuasive nor universal, while the good things are. If we find permanent and universal causes for good events, with temporary and specific causes for misfortune, we achieve what Seligman suggests is a process that builds optimism and hope. Now, I think people have a tendency sometimes to look at situations they're in, the painful ones, and dwell on them and make them bigger than they are. For example, I know a woman, one of my relatives, in fact, who is having a trouble with her relationship with her daughter, her grown daughter. And she says, well, if I told her what I really think, she would have nothing more to do with me. She would say, I'm no longer your daughter, you're not my mother, and she'd never speak to me anymore. And you know, I wanted to gently disagree with that or argue with that. I said, how do you know that she would do that? Is that really realistic? And I suggested, you know, I don't think it is. I think that if you tell her what's on your mind, it might be a little difficult, but you'll get through it. You know, you'll both be glad that you were honest with each other, and you might feel better that you've said what you needed to say, and she'll feel better because you've been honest with her and shared with her, and it may even bring you closer. But I think a lot of times we build things up in our minds to be worse than they are. So one of my favorite characters growing up was Jack Webb. You remember what Jack Webb said? Just the facts, ma'am. Yeah, you got it, didn't you? Yeah. It's true. You know, the trouble is that when we have beliefs about the situation, what are they? They are beliefs. They're just our concept of what it is all about, whatever the issue is. But when you go to the facts and deal with those and put those together, it might look quite different. I suggest that we miss a lot of opportunities by building things up in ways that we don't need to. The third and final general area that Seligman talks about that we have under our control to be happy is what he calls pleasures and gratifications. And he defines them a little differently. Pleasures, he says, are the delights that are immediate, sensory, and momentary. And his example is tasting French vanilla ice cream, which is a very powerful example to me. I happen to love that, among many things. But what he says is that when you taste French vanilla ice cream, the first bite, you get this burst of wonderful flavor, and you really enjoy it. And so you take a second bite, and it's not quite as good as the first, but it's still mighty good. And the third one is a little bit less good than the first two, but still pretty good. And so it goes on and on until at some point there's a point of diminishing returns where one bite tastes like another one. And the reason for that is that our nerves react to stimulus, and when we keep doing the same stimulus over and over again, the nerves say, oh yeah, we know about that, been there, done that, and they don't react in the same way. So Seligman says, if you just have 5 bites of vanilla ice cream, that's all you really need. I've been trying to figure that one out and apply it, but I just realized something changes in our enjoyment. It goes from mouth to stomach at some point. But anyway, if we keep on doing the same thing, it's not as fun as it was to begin with. The other type of pleasure that he talks about is what he calls gratification, which refers to the good feeling that we have in doing things that are important to us, that fulfill us, that we really feel good about. They're tasks that are challenging, that require our best, require skill. And when we do them, they have a deep, effortless involvement. We have a sense of control, and our sense of self vanishes, and even our sense of time can go away. Now, I don't know if this reminds you of anything that you do. And when I was thinking for an example, I don't know if this will be meaningful for you or not, but it was for me. When I gave thought to this subject, my mind went back to when I was only 12 years old. And in the summer, we were visiting my grandparents, and I went out and bought a model, a plastic model, and the name of the model was the Long Tom. Now, the Long Tom was a cannon, a piece of artillery that was very long, and it was towed by a tractor. And I remember working on that project, and I gave it my all, full concentration. I didn't know what time it was. I didn't care. I gave it everything I had. And I have to say that, looking back on it, that was probably the closest to perfection of making a model that I was ever capable of. But it made an impression on me that even a few years ago, I was trying to think of, you know, what things I really care about most, and my prayer was for that Long Tom experience. In other words, that I would be that passionate about the things that I'm doing now. Maybe there's some like that for you. I hope so. Or if not, maybe you can discover some. So, in the scriptures, Jesus calls his followers to a new life, a full, abundant life, deeply satisfying, a happy life. Not superficially happy, not one based on selfish or fleeting desires, but the sort of life that one looks back on and feels proud and satisfied. So, again, I encourage us all to be authentic happyologists and revision historians. And my hope and prayer for each one of you is that this week, maybe today, or sometime this week, you will experience some new happiness. Amen. And don't forget, if you want a copy,